board. Oh, very good. Thank you very much. Everyone in the back can hear me okay? All right.
Say Schultz, ADL, May 1, 2019.
Okay, well, we'll see how this goes. So thank you all for coming today and for listening to me talk about the future of training and education. And so that's my name. I put it on the slide because I often get questions like, what's your name again? How do you spell it? So that's why. And then here's a little mnemonic for you all. So say, like a speech bubble, shots. Okay, now you're going to remember who I am, right? So this is me. So I used to have credibility back in the day. So I used to be an applied field researcher. So that's me out there doing some field research. That's me in Georgia, the country, not the state. There's me with important people talking. I know it looks like I'm in the like witness protection program at this point, but it's okay. And so these are the different military books that I've helped author over the years, including this latest one. So thank you very much for the kind regards on that one. That one is free. Please use it. Please plagiarize it. Please you know, take it and be have initiative in all of these things, right? Be inventive and reason it. So this is where I work now, which means that I no longer have the cred of actually doing the work. I'm now mainly paperwork. But I think that's part of the reason of why I was invited up here. But that's not what you want to hear about, right? Today, what we really want to hear about is, what is the future of the way that we train and educate, and how do we get there? So I feel like, with any kind of audience like this, that I kind of need to start with our roots. So I kind of need to start with this guy. All right, so who is this guy? Does anyone know? I'm hearing it, yes? It's Clausewitz, right? So this is where so much of our foundation, well done, thank you, sir.
That
would be pretty bad. I was going to say, this was like a test for you all. So much of the way that we do professional military education, right, oftentimes comes from the work of Clausewitz. And so he lived at the end of the 18th century, beginning of the 19th. He wrote On War, right, the classic treatise that we often use, around 1816 to 1830. Now, what was happening at that time in the world? Well, we had the predecessor of the bicycle, not the full bicycle yet, that was just being invented. We had the first predecessor of photography, and matches were first invented. So this is what's happening at the time that the foundation of what we teach oftentimes in PME, and in training as well, was coming about. Now, this is not to cast aspersions on Clausewitz's work, but the point I'm trying to create is that back in that time, the concept of fog of war often meant we don't know what's going on. There's ambiguity, there's lack of communication, there's lack of clarity. Today, though, we have the exact opposite. You heard the general and the chief talk about this, right? We have data all at our fingertips. We have so much information available to us on the internet, on YouTube, on people's opinions, on social media. Today, the fog of war is more about the glut of information that we have versus the lack of it. There's some really funny terms that are used for this. Infobesity, infotoxication, data smog, infopollution, right? It's very funny, but you know, the effects of it aren't really such a laughing matter, because you start to think about, how does this impact the way we think? We oftentimes are information rich, but knowledge poor. And so we're in this paradox now, where we have all of this stuff going on around us, all of this information bombarding us, creating this signal-to-noise issue, while at the same time, the operational environment around us is also increasing in complexity. In fact, some might even argue, right, it's not just the changing nature, it's not just the changing character of war, but really even almost the changing nature. As we start to have all of this noise, we have the gray zone conflicts, right? So we're doing not just traditional operations, but looking at information operations, cybersecurity, financial operations, things blended across different phases of warfare, right? So you have low intensity conflicts, small groups, while you have conventional, all at the same time, all happening around us. And this is the kind of environment that we're having to operate in and having our minds operate in. So I often like to say at this point in time, when I'm talking about this sort of thing, that it's our job as trainers, as educators, as people who think about human capital, to figure out ways to make sure that our personnel have more capabilities that are needed for this environment, right? So they don't just need to move, shoot, and communicate, but they need to also have good cybersecurity skills and good language skills, and also be able to probably do some battlefield first aid, and they probably need to have some awareness of global politics and so on and so forth, right? To be able to cope with this environment. They also tend to need these skills at a higher level. And by the way, when I say skills, take this as knowledge, skills, attitudes, abilities, and all that other stuff, right? So all of these competencies, they need them at a higher level of sophistication. So in other words, you don't just need good decision making, but you need good strategic decision making, right? You can't just memorize multiple choice tables, multiplication tables. You need to know the theory behind mathematics, right? A higher level of sophistication here for all of these capabilities. And they need to do it with greater agility, because the world around us changes so quickly. You have to learn something, unlearn it, learn something new, and constantly have all this information at our fingertips, right? That's why we get the YouTube, these social media circles, and so on. And so then this ends up being the challenge for our trainers and educators, is to instill this broader, deeper, and more rapidly updating set of capabilities in our personnel. But there's a challenge when we start to go back and think about the fog of war and really what that means for our folks. Let me tell you a little vignette, and then we'll come back to this. So there's a course that I teach in sometimes. It's for U.S. military civilians who are getting ready to deploy overseas to support in advisory roles. It could be for things like logistics, it could be things like training. So in places like Afghanistan and Iraq and so on. And so I teach about decision making, and I teach about how they make good decisions and how they can help mentor others in making good decisions. So one of the things I like to talk about in that course is this notion of the elephant and the rider. This is a metaphor for the way our brains work. So the rider represents our system two, or our very logical brain, our involved brain, our prefrontal cortex concept. It's logical, it's calculating. This is how you actually work out the math problems, right? So it's slow, it's effortful. This is what we all tend to think about and think, oh, my mind, right? Our elephant brain, on the other hand, is fast, it's subconscious, it's intuitive, it's emotional. It is our system one. It's our more, you might call it your lizard brain, or right, it's your more primitive brain. And it's reacting quickly to things. The reason that the metaphor works is because you feel like, as the rider, you're in control, right? You're telling the elephant where to go, you're looking out ahead, you're talking to other riders, you're making plans. But if the elephant wants to go to the left, there is nothing that the rider can do. That elephant is going where it wants to go. And it is big, and it is oftentimes in charge. The other thing about this metaphor is that they have to work together. It's not like one is inherently better than the other. This is just the way that our brains work. This is our system one and system two. Let me show you some examples about how this works in practice. So what happened? All right, so you guys laughed. I mean, what, split second and you laughed, right? So this could be some sort of horrible, tragic picture, but you instantly picked up on the details and you're like, no, I know what happened here, right? Here, help me out here. What's going on here? Right, he had a really fun night. Yeah, in New Orleans, right? Yeah, exactly. So you picked up all these details in like a split second. That's your system one in practice. Your system one is really good. It just takes in all the details all at once, and it processes like a big AI algorithm or something. It just takes everything in and it spits out an answer, and it's like, look, I picked up on all these little tiny details. I figured out what happened very quickly. System one, working very quickly for you. Here's another example. What do you see here? Right, it's a panda bear. Because your system one again is taking in all the details and saying, this is what I think is going on. Now, obviously, we know in our logical brains, this is just a series of some shapes, right? There's not really anything there. But we're able to see the pattern from the underlying details, thanks to our system one. How about here? What do you see in these pictures? Right, they're faces, right? And obviously, we know logically, with our writer minds, that's just, you know, those are just funny bricks and things, but we cannot help but see the pattern from these underlying details. What letter of the alphabet is this? You're not sure, right? It could be a number of things. But how about if I do this? Now what letter of the alphabet is the first one? Right, obviously it's an H. And the second one? A. And it's very difficult to unsee it, isn't it? Again, this is your system one in action. Your system one is highly contextual. It picks up on all of these details and then spits out the answer. And so this is good, right? Could you imagine if we had to logically think through everything we wanted to do, right? If we wanted to like assess that picture of the football fan by looking at every single detail, or think about how we walk across the room by thinking, all right, first I pick up my right leg and then I set it down and I better move my arm, and right? You couldn't function like that. So you need that system one. Your system one is also highly emotional. It responds to things like, oh, that's cute, I feel good now, things are good. Or that's scary. Or, ooh, that's gross, oh. Palate cleanser, okay, there you go. So it picks up on all of those emotional details as well. And again, it infuses it into this big algorithm that spits out the answer, whether or not they're relevant. Your system one also is easily tricked by things. So you all know that this is an optical illusion, right? I mean, you've probably seen this exact one before. So I'm going to tell you that that table, the height is the same as that table's width. You know this is probably true. Look, I'll prove it. See, look, truth. Okay, now as soon as I make that go away, your system one is back to that cannot possibly be the case. They do not look like they're the same size. No, it just does not believe it. Now, this is what your system two, or your more logical rider mind, likes to do. Now, I'm not going to make anybody do math in public, so don't worry. But you could do it, well, maybe not everybody's children at this point in time, but we could probably generally do this if we needed to, right? And that would be your system two in action, like logical, concerted. Let's do an easier math problem, though. So, a bat and a ball together cost $1.10. The bat is $1 more than the ball. How much does the ball cost? Yell it out, this is easier. I'm hearing 10 cents, right? So the correct answer, that's what your elephant brain would like you to believe, because that's a nice, pretty, nice pattern there. But the correct answer, as our rider minds actually know, is 5 cents, right? Because it's a dollar more. So 5 cents, right? Yeah, exactly. So
you were doing the conversion on the American dollar.
Where's the cat? Well, so this is an example of how you can see how they can kind of interact with each other. And sometimes your elephant brain can override your rider brain, and you may not even realize it. So you have this rider brain, right? This more evolved brain that's all about reason and logic. And you have your emotional, your intuitive, your contextual brain that is all about these kind of fast, integrated decisions. Unfortunately, your elephant brain tends to be, it's in addition to fast, intuitive, and emotional, which can be quite good things, right? But in addition to that, it tends to be quite nervous. It likes to go with the risk-free answers on things. It likes to avoid loss. It gets very, very nervous about loss. And in fact, if you have an opportunity or here, but the potential for a loss, it will just shy away even from the opportunity if there's a risk involved, unless it's a really, really high benefit. It also tends to be quite angry and emotional. It takes, you know, those emotions that it gets from wherever, and it applies those to what it's thinking and what it's processing. And it kind of tends to be lazy. It likes to go with whatever the easiest answer is. It likes to pick up on whatever the surface details are and just go with that. The first one, that makes sense. Let's, right, that's like the, that's 10% or 10 cents, that's it. Like, we're just gonna go with the first answer. Now, our rider brains control the elephant, right? It has the, you know, the chain around the elephant's neck and it's telling it where to go. In fact, in cognitive psychology, you can call this executive control. Very professional looking brain there. And so we have that executive control of the rider that helps us mitigate some of these biases or some of these incorrect answers that the elephant brain might do. The problem is that there is a fuel tank associated with this. And every time we make a decision, exert willpower, have to control our elephant brain, it depletes a little bit of that fuel tank. And so as our decision resources reduce, that elephant brain starts to run around quite a bit more. So think back to what we were talking about a little bit ago, right? About this bombardment of information around us all the time. Every time we're processing this new information, this new factoid, we're reaching out, we're talking to people, that's depleting a little bit more of our fuel tank. You know, you can refuel that with mindfulness, right? That's good. With rest, with other things, but it has an impact. Now, we see this in practice, by the way. So you see this in less ethical business contexts a lot. One of the techniques that they often use is to have a really thick contract. Like, let's say you're getting a used car, right? And you have this very thick contract that you're given, and it has all these questions throughout it. And it starts with things like, would you like to have a steering wheel? And you're like, yeah, steering wheel, pretty important. Would you like windshield wipers? Yeah. Doormats? Yeah. Okay. So what's happening? You're depleting your decision-making resources. So by the time you get to the end of the contract where it's like, would you like this very expensive extended warranty? And you're like, I don't care. Just let me go with the easiest answer. My elephant brain is taking over, and it's tired, and it wants to go with the most expedient, most risk-free, just easiest service answer. And so it's really effective in those cases. It's actually been shown in voting, too. So there's a really interesting longitudinal analysis done of California voting. And in different areas in California, the proposals on the voting ballot are in different orders. So the researchers were able to go back and look and see which propositions would have passed if they were listed higher up sooner on the ballot versus lower down later. They found that out of 352 propositions that they examined, 22 would have passed simply by putting it sooner on the ballot. You also see this even with judges. So there's really strong findings that people who go up for parole hearings later in the day are disproportionately told no versus people who go up early. In fact, this is even used in court sometimes as a counter-argument because people find that the judge's decision-making resources go down over time. They get a little bump up after lunch, interestingly, but then they start to go down again. And so this is, again, they're defaulting to that elephant brain. We see it also in some of the tactics that you see adversaries using, right? So some of the social media information operations. Oftentimes, these are not intended to be a way of convincing people to the information operation message, right, to the propaganda. Sometimes it's just about creating enough noise that people don't know where the signal is, or where they just get tired and they disengage. This is, again, getting back to the information overload. So let's return to our original story here. You remember we were talking about how the environment around us is changing, and it's highly complex, and it's interconnected, and we have global operations, and we have a lot of pressure on our CAF members and other military personnel to think strategically and have a huge bag of competencies and to be constantly adapting and constantly evolving. And then you have you as the trainers and educators in the middle of it, trying to negotiate between all of these capabilities that our personnel need to be able to develop and learn, while at the same time recognizing that we have this challenge of information overload and real serious risks. We are at risk, if we don't do this correctly, of shooting ourselves in the foot, right? Of adding to the cacophony of information overload, of infobesity, of data smog to our personnel, and triggering their elephant brains in the process. So what do we do about it? This goes back to what the general was talking about, right? We have to evolve the way that we train and educate, because if we keep with our current system, we are going to have both the issue of being behind and not being able to keep up with the pace, and at the same time, just pushing out all of this information in a sort of like information exposure way that is actually damaging our personnel, not helping them. So how do we evolve the system? Or maybe I should say, where do we evolve from to? I would say that today the system that we're in is called the information age. You probably heard industrial age. You've probably heard this before, right? We have the industrial age of training and education. And this is actually, back to our old friend here, this was actually during Clausewitz's time that this was developed. It's sometimes called the Prussian education system. In fact, he probably taught in this back in the day. Anyway, fun fact. So what do we think of as this industrial age system? Well, it tends to be fairly time delineated, right? I go to first grade from this year to this year. I go to second grade from this year to this year. And I go to the training academy from this month to that month. I then do this, and then I go to that school, and then I go to this exercise, right? Very much based upon time. It tends to be fairly assembly line-like, right? And you see this particularly in case through 16, but you see it in the military as well, right? So I'm in first grade, and then I must go to second grade, and then I must go on to the third grade, right? It's very much a progression. People are on an assembly line or a conveyor belt. It tends to be one size fits all, right? This is how we're going to learn about electrons. If you don't like it, too bad. This is how we're learning it, right? This is how we're learning about inertia. You must learn it the way we all do. It tends to be input focused. In other words, focused on the teaching or focused on the content versus focused on the mastery level or the performance ability of the students at the end, right? So whatever level they come out at is fine as long as they end at the correct time. Less about let's hold performance static and let time vary or focus on the student outcomes. It tends to be passive, PowerPoint based, sort of like this, but ignore that part. And it tends to be focused on transferring facts and procedures, right? Memorize this, learn how to do, you know, this rifle assembly and disassembly, right? At a very fact or skill level. Now, I do have to say that this is a bit apocryphal, right? This is a metaphor. We know that this is not the case in all schools and in all training centers. We know that there are lots of places of excellence out there. But to draw a contrast, this is the kind of status quo example that we're trying to evolve from. So what are we going to? Well, we want to go to this information age of learning. And you already heard about this at the beginning, right? So we want to go to this information age that's appropriate for learners of today's context. It needs to be a lifelong continuum because the information around us is constantly evolving. We cannot simply learn something once and then hope that it'll be the case for the rest of our lives. We want it to be interconnected so that you don't have these stovepipe or staccato learning experiences where I go to a class here, and then I go to an exercise there, and then I go to a simulator here, but they're all separate. They all treat me like a blank slate. We want them instead to be interconnected, so I get a more cohesive, more strategic exposure to learning. We want it personalized. I want the learning that I need, when I need it, at the time and in the ways that I need it. And I need to be outcome focused, right? I need to achieve a certain level of mastery, not just sit in a seat for a certain amount of time. Let's be active, let's be engaged. What does that mean? Well, it could mean anything, right? It could be hands-on, it could be on the job, it could be even a self-learning, like looking things up on YouTube could be quite active, right? But we want to be not just passive receivers of information, but somehow really internalizing it and being engaged.
And we want to focus not just on these more superficial facts and procedures, but looking at the full 21st century competencies. So at a more, at a deeper level of those knowledge and skills, but also looking at social and emotional capabilities, looking at metacognitive and emotional and motivational and other kinds of facets that are often below the surface. So this really translates to the concept of we need to be constantly learning, right? Learning, unlearning, relearning across our lives, across diverse contexts and media, different forms. They all need to be interconnected. They need to be appropriate for what we have. Learning at the point of need sometimes, right? That might be looking the video up on YouTube or phone a friend. It could be also informal and experiential, right? So that phone a friend, that look things up on YouTube, that's informal. Experiential, on the job. Obviously, we need to be getting to more and different knowledge, skills, attitudes, and other facets. And we tend to call this, or like I like to call this, the future learning ecosystem. Ecosystem, because there's a lot of things growing in it. Future, because it's the future. And learning, because within this large, diverse community, we are going to be fostering learning. So it has the interconnectedness. It has a focus on assessment and measurement, so we can personalize and emphasize mastery. It has a focus on learning science, so that we can ensure the correct pedagogy or andragogy of given people. It has a focus on using social and informal methods in addition to the formal. And it has a focus on overall strategic outcomes. All right, a lot of talking. And I see from the body language, you're like, all right, I'm full at this point. So let's watch a short video about what this might look like in the future. So this starts out, and this is, sorry, US based, but you get the idea here. We have a young soldier, and she's at home doing a little bit of self-development. So she's reading here. And because the system is interconnected, it knows that she's doing the self-development, and it updates her universal learner profile so that she gets credit for the work she's doing, and it updates its estimate of her competency in that area. Now, while she's looking at it, she realizes she forgot to do her pre-training for an upcoming exercise, because even in the future, people wait until the last minute to do their homework. So she's like, okay, well, let me go in here, and let me find my friends, right? This is the social part of it. Let me find some friends and see if they can do it with me. Her friends, not surprisingly, also waited until the last minute. VR helmet here. Not too much of a stranger. You guys are laughing, but I'll tell you a story about it. Not too far away. So they're doing their VR activity. Don't worry about the specifics of what they're doing. The idea is simply that they're doing some, you know, VR activity here together, collaboratively, from home. And they're getting actual scores. What did you think about that final story?
That was awesome, especially when we got to practice on our own.
What was your rating?
Check this out.
Here we go. Yeah, what'd you get? Oh, very nice.
So you can see some actual scores here, not just the pass-fail kind of
thing. I wonder who our third teammate is.
Took away an assignment from the trainer.
So in this case, the trainer is empowered, able to look at the most relevant competencies for the team that he's putting together, and then put together the team based upon the best fit across those. Again, pulling from that universal learner, the universal service member profile about them all.
Here's our new assignment. I know this guy. He's great. We're going to have a good team.
with one another, and now they're going into their training exercise. So there's a cybersecurity training exercise. These are some nondescript, wearable, neurophysiological devices. The idea is simply being you can get different data streams coming in. And the trainer, you see, is actually powered by, not replaced by, the technology. So he's able to monitor the different teams' neurophysiological measures, their performance as the red team, so he's on the bad guy team. So you can see in this idea of learning all the time. But wait, if we're learning all the time, what does that mean for the elephant brain? And across diverse contexts and across diverse media, but wow, that's a lot of stuff that I'm monitoring all over the place. And it's learning at the point of need, but if I'm at a point of need, then aren't I needing to pay attention to other things? And it's informal and experiential and it's so there's like lots of goodness here, but at the same time, we are at this place of risk where we may be being bombarded with information constantly. And there's a potential that there's a lack of coherency in that information that we're being bombarded with, right? So I might be getting information from my social media, from my smartphone, and from my YouTube, and from my course, and from my training simulator, but maybe it doesn't all fit together nicely. Maybe it's actually more confusing than helpful. It's at the point of need, but maybe it doesn't link to one another in an effective way. Maybe I don't have time to reflect upon it. And it's informal and experiential, but that really puts a lot of pressure on the student to be able to integrate all of that information, to know when they get to a point of overload, or for the trainee to be able to say, yes, I do need that information right now, let me go find it. So while there's a lot of goodness in this concept of learning all the time across diverse sources, having it at the point of need, blending across different modalities, this is excellent. That vision is pretty cool, right? Especially with like the wearables, it's like super cool. But at the same time, we're in this conundrum where our elephant brains may be able to run amok if we're not careful. So how do we ensure that we don't just get more information, more data available, while at the same time risking the reduction in the quality of that? This is a really confusing question, right? So what can we do as a training and education community to help walk the line between the needs of the world around us, which obviously need to go to this concept of this information age or this future learning ecosystem, while at the same time ensuring that we have good quality learning science, good quality outcomes throughout the process. So I have three recommendations for you, specific things you can do to help walk this line. And don't make a mistake here. This really is you that needs to do this. The technologists are going to make the technology that you saw in that video, right? The the HR, the talent management system, is going to work towards interconnected training, education, HR, recruiting, all of these other things, right? We are going in that direction. It really is the impetus of the TDOs, of the instructional designers, of the training and education community writ large to ensure that we don't fall down the trap of elephant brain information overload. All right, so off my soapbox, sorry. But so what do we do about it? Okay, so number one, you need to teach self-regulatory knowledge, skills, attitudes, and other capabilities. Self-regulation is things like metacognition, right, control of your own emotions, recognizing when your knowledge or ability is below what it needs to be, and then having the initiative and knowledge and ability to go seek out the information or other capabilities you need. So teaching self-regulation is kind of like teaching people to put the elephant into a box, right? And giving them the capabilities to have better control over that and to better assess and to better monitor themselves. The nice thing about this is it's completely teachable. This has been shown. You can absolutely teach these kind of capabilities. Obviously, it's increasingly needed, and it's really impactful. Meta-analytic studies have shown that it accounts for about 17% of the variance in student learning outcomes. That is a huge impact. Anything in education and training domain that has that kind of impact is just crazy, right? So this is a really important thing for us to be fostering in CAP members and beyond. Let me give you an example. So this is Julius Yago. Anybody, who knows who this is? Okay, very good. So well, this list is exciting too, so I can introduce the rest of you to this. So Julius is a gold medal winner in javelin in the Olympics. But let me show you the video about him. You get to know who he is before I go into it in more detail.
They have an inward meaning. We have them in close up here. We were just using a stick. Some boys were competing. And then something came into my mind and told me, you can beat these guys. When I broke the junior record, I felt that my life now will change. In Kenya, it's not easy, not quite clean, kind of me. I was just alone in the field, training. My father wanted me to get one thing. Everybody here in Kenya is a runner. I took it as a challenge to find another way to succeed. I started watching videos. The last episode.
The elevation of that level is just on your height, the level of your height.
I would see that training like these people can improve me. I started now using a different mode of training, gym exercises, flexibility exercises, everything changed. I was always increasing my distance. It's me and the YouTube videos. I was doing better and better. I won the first gold ever for Kenya. In the same event, I broke the national record. Now I went to the Olympics. Imagine being in the finals in the Olympics. There was no light. I was at the end of the tunnel. And here in Kenya, I have a nickname. Mr. YouTube man. The world progresses, everything changes. So maybe one time many people will be learning things in the same.
So that is self-regulated learning in the extreme, right? Taught himself how to get a gold medal from YouTube. But why? How does this work? Well, there's actually been quite a bit of research on how to teach or how to assess or how to describe self-regulated learning. So the most approachable model kind of has three levels. First, you have to be able to understand performance. You need to have that kind of metacognitive or kind of that yourself, looking at yourself sort of ability while you're performing. So so you can clearly assess how well you're doing, what areas you need to improve on. You also need to have very good control of your attention, so you're not getting distracted, you're able to focus and put the right amount of attention on the right things at the right time. That also means that you have to have good self-reflection. After you do some sort of performance, you need to be able to determine accurately, what did I do correctly? What did I do wrong? And do this in a way that's not super emotional, but is like, you know, very clear and practical. And then how do I go on and do something to improve upon those areas that need improvement? It also has an element of before task consideration, this kind of forethought element, the ability to plan, to set goals, to understand what you need to do in a particular case. These are all teachable skills. So maybe we were not all born like Julius, but I think we could be, in the sense of we could teach these self-regulation abilities to our personnel and start to give them some of the tools that he has to succeed. This brings us to the second actionable recommendation of the day. We need to acknowledge and embrace informal learning. Informal learning is anything that's happening outside of a formal training and education space. So something that's not necessarily, you know, planned. Like if you have a syllabus, it's formal learning, right? If you have a curriculum, if you have defined training and education outcomes, it's formal learning. But other stuff, like watching YouTube videos, like calling your friends, like mentorship, like on-the-job learning, these tend to be informal. And so we really need to look at these opportunities. So generally speaking, and don't take these numbers as gospel, but generally speaking, people estimate that somewhere between, you know, 70 to even 90% of the learning that we get in life is either informal or social. These ideas of it's non-formal, like it's semi-structured, like here I have a mentor, you know, it's not like there's some assignment, but it's not really structured, or it's completely informal, like I'm just watching videos, right? So things like classes and e-learning and exercises, how much of the effort do we here spend on that? We probably spend 90% of our effort there, while these other things, like workshops and conferences and social learning and experiential learning really are, in a lot of ways, the core of what we get. So how do we start to uncover the rest of the iceberg? How do we get to being more intentional in supporting people's informal learning? I mean, by definition, if we start to like really construct it out and architect it, then it becomes formal learning, right? So it's one of those like, almost like a Schrodinger's cat or a Heisenberg uncertainty principle kind of thing, right? You can't touch it and not affect it. But there are ways that we can better facilitate it in our members and give them credit for the things that they learn in these informal or non-formal ways, or to set up the conditions that might foster it a bit better. Let me give you one example, because I know that there's a lot that we could talk about here. But let me just give you one place that you can start to pull the thread. I think that there's a really rich opportunity with fostering social learning. Social learning is that kind of peer-to-peer learning. It's where you have, you know, your 900 friends on your social media. I mean, that's social learning in a lot of ways. And you see that here in professional contexts. I mean, how many times have you gotten a form that you have to fill out, or you know, you have some sort of task that you're just not familiar with? And you know that there's that person you call, hey, have you seen this form before? What do they really want? Or I have this test coming up, can you tell me about it, right? We do it all the time. But we do it in these kind of, you know, catch-as-catch-can sort of ways. How do we as an organization help foster the conditions to make quality, healthy social learning in the organization more likely? So I'm not going to go into the details here, because that's a whole series of talks all on its own. But I will say that there is quite a bit of work out there. And I like the work from Julian Stodd. And he's actually written one of the chapters in the book that you saw from Bill a few minutes ago, too. So you can read that, and you can start to get some of the ideas from him about how you actually foster the communities that to start to get us to these ideas about how we leverage technology and social communities to create the conditions for healthy social learning within organizations. The other thing I like about his work is that he puts all of this up for free on his blog, and so you can go and you can read it all and see the applications in the real world with real companies and how this has worked, and then techniques that you could use in your own situation. And then finally, the third recommendation that I have for you all is that we need to start looking at these 21st century competencies, right? So we cannot simply look at how do I memorize or teach procedures. We need to start looking at the higher order thinking skills. How do I strategize? How do I analyze situations? How do I understand the theory? How do I ask why? But more than that, I need to think about intra and interpersonal abilities. I need to think about things like empathy, or self-regulation, or metacognition, motivation, all of these things that are oftentimes below the surface. So if I search for 21st century competencies, by the way, you will find umpteen million hits. Now, this is Google Scholar. This is like even like trying to be more specific, right? And it's in quotes, so you know that it's really tailored. And still, we have over 3,000 people who have models of what 21st century competencies mean, right? And if I look up Wikipedia, right, this is the first place we all go, endeavoring hit, right, that's our first self-regulated learning place. So if I go there, you'll see that there are all sorts of models out there of what a 21st century competency model might look like. Pretty good entry, actually, by the way. And then there's some from ICT, Time Magazine talked about them recently. This is from the US Army. There's another one here from, this is from you all, right? There you go, so you have your own 21st century competency. I see by the shocked faces that everyone's like, I didn't know that existed. It's okay, you can look it up now.
That's not bad.
What?
Oh, nothing. Local politics.
Oh, okay. Well, don't look at that then. Ignore that. The point is, oh, there we go. There's some more ones. This is actually really interesting because this is from your book, or the one we don't want to talk about. I'm not really getting the message. But anyway, so there's a whole bunch of different ones out there. The point is, it doesn't really matter. It's kind of like a collectible card game. I thank you for getting my nerd joke. I appreciate it. So it's kind of like a collectible card game, right? Like, let's collect all of the 21st century competency models. So like, which one do you have? But it doesn't really matter, right? The thing that matters ultimately is that we're trying to get below the iceberg, that we're trying to get past the idea of just the knowledge and skills, right? So we have these, so we need to think about things like, what are the new kinds of conceptual, contextual skills that people need? How do we start to look at that? And then what are the kinds of perennial skills? So this is a really basic way of thinking about knowledge and skills, kind of putting them into two buckets. You know, what are things that we do now that we need to do better in the future, right? So not just memorization, but this kind of like understanding theory. And then what are some things that the future requires because it's new and there are things that we've never had to do before, but we have new requirements. That's what's going on here. So on the one side, right, collaboration. That is something we've always needed to do, but we need to do it differently and better now, right? We need to be able to survive with these networks of social media and technology-mediated relationships and do it in a way that integrates with our lives. So it's a new set of capabilities in an old need. We need to be able to co-create knowledge across distributed tech-mediated environments. Who wrote that? That's like really complicated. But I think the chief actually gave a really good example of this, right? This is people need to feel comfortable being able to distribute their decision-making and to think across teams in these kind of environments via technology. On the new skills side of things, we need to think about how do we find information in a very disorderly world, right? Where you have all this noise, all this competing information online. Some of it may be true, some of it may be false, it's partial. So how do we start to navigate that? One of the perennial skills we need is lifelong learning, right? So we've always needed that, but today it has more gravity to it. And it means something different than just, hey, let me make sure I read the newspaper every morning. This is, I need to constantly stay on top of my field, almost no matter what field it is, you'll constantly be needing to refresh. Harvard has a project called the 60-year curriculum. And they use this term because they recognize that people are going to have somewhere between 5 to 7 careers in their lifetime. Careers, not jobs, but full-on different careers from the ages of 15 to 75. 60 years of lifelong learning. We also need greater cognitive, emotional, and self-regulation. I think I've already foot stomped to this one enough, but we need it at a higher level than we ever have before. And we need to have greater, oftentimes globally centered, interpersonal skills. Obviously something we've always needed, but something that now has a much greater context. We often talk in the US military about the notion of strategic corporal, right? And so it's the idea that someone who's out there at a very low rank could have a blunder or maybe something really amazing and positive that ends up having a strategic impact. And oftentimes it comes down to these things that have to do with people interactions, right? So we need to have those at a higher level. Back on the new skills for the new environment sort of side, we need to be able to have more awareness of information and media. You often hear this of, like, I need to be information literate, or I need to be, right, internet literate, so you know that you can go out there and where to find sources, how to trust them, which ones are biased, and so on. Distributed cognition, right? Feeling comfortable knowing how to work in distributed teams so that not just one person has all the knowledge and skills, but it's distributed and interactive. Working with non-linear information, stitching together things from different sources to make the idea come alive. And then I think in the middle, the idea of unlearning. Really a critical concept for us. I mean, if you look at like laws or policies, this is a good example. We're so good at making up new policies, right? You know, I don't know how many policies you have in the CAP, but I don't know. Okay, so this is good. This is a universal thing, right? So we have a lot in the DoD as well. How often do we actually go back and eliminate old policies? Very rarely. That's much more difficult. We want to move forward. But think about this from the perspective of knowledge and skills. How often do we go back and reconsider the old things that we've learned to then make sure that we're going in the right direction going forward? Maybe because the environment around us has changed. So that's going to be a really important skill in the future. And then, of course, these are all like generic, right? So this is like if you're a doctor or a lawyer or a high school teacher, all of these are important in the future. But there's some really specific military things that we need to consider, such as globally integrated operations, right? Systems thinking across operations around the world, not just isolated to particular regional areas. How do we think about joint, interagency, interorganizational, and multinational operations? In other words, I don't know if that acronym translates, but the idea is, you know, we're never going to have some sort of organizational activity that is just the CAF military. You're going to be integrated with other governmental organizations, probably NGOs, probably some international actors as well, no matter what you're doing. And so how do we start to think in this kind of environment, and how do we plan for that? And then finally, how do we start to think of these kind of whole of society strategic movements? So again, if we go back to that example, let's say that there's some sort of environmental activity, like a big earthquake someplace. What does that mean for society overall, right? We might have the crisis response, but then maybe that also tanks the stock market for a little while. And then maybe we also need to start to work with civilians in the area to make sure that they get out and get safe. And then maybe that affects jobs in that area for a while and it gets depressed. So there's all these second and third order effects that we really need to be thinking about at the strategic level. So when I say 21st century competencies, this is kind of the sort of thing I think through. Don't take this as a rubric or a list. I mean, we all know there are enough out there for that, right? We don't need another one. But this is more of the kind of framework that I think through when I think about them. The point being that we need to get to that. So I've probably given you PowerPoint overload at this point in time, the fog of PowerPoint. But let me recap a little bit about where we've come. So here's the summary. And then plus one thing at the end, one save round. At the end, by the way, everybody can wake up now. At the end, we're going to have a short discussion. So here's what we're going to discuss so you can be thinking about your answers. What's the practical application of what we discussed here for the Canadian Armed Forces? At a tactical level, but also at the operational and strategic level. So, and what I mean by that is like in a classroom, in your simulator, in what you do on a day-to-day basis, but also organizationally. What kind of impacts or changes at that level do you need to consider? And so then here's the recap of where we're going. So, in summary, information overload can be a really big challenge. It's been a challenge already, just the way our society is, and there's a risk that we can make it worse. But at the same time, we have these expanding requirements. Personnel need more, deeper, and more agile knowledge, skills, attitudes, abilities. And we need to be able to deliver that training and education more, better, faster, right? But that just leads us to more information overload. So we are in a real risk here of fostering cognitive biases by our intervention, by our treatment of the problem. So how do we overcome this? How do we avoid the angry, emotional, nervous, lazy elephant while at the same time getting to those learning and development outcomes that we really want? Right? How do we avoid encouraging the elephant to be risk averse, stick with the status quo, and avoiding optimal decisions for the expedient ones, or only focusing on the surface information? Right? This is a real risk we could create. Oh, and by the way, right, the elephant is usually completely unaware that this is happening. So that goes back to the self-regulated learning. So we need this more, better, faster. And we know that there's a technology solution that's going to help us with part of it, right? So we're going to have this learner-centric, technology-connected ecosystem that's driven by data so it can be more personalized. In other words, be more optimized in how we train and educate. We can have learning science that helps us mitigate some of this and actively supports the integration of informal, self-study, social learning, and gets us integrated across different organizational functions. Which gets us to the more, better, faster. Except that if we don't use it correctly, we actually then are fostering these negative outcomes. So that's where you all come in, right, as the training and education community here, to stand up for those things that we know will help mitigate that challenge. The teaching self-regulatory knowledge, skills, attitudes, and other abilities. The ability to acknowledge and embrace informal learning, to create those opportunities, for instance, to have a culture of social learning, and to integrate those 21st century outcomes, those social, emotional, and cultural outcomes into the training and education space. And then this is the plus one that I said, right? This is the saved round. As you think about this going forward, I would recommend that you make small incremental changes over time. Have an iterative approach. In other words, we want to make sure that we are careful to adhere to Gall's Law, one of my favorite ones. It says that any successful complex system invariably involves the simple system that worked. Yeah. Right? Right. So if we try to make this future learning ecosystem overall, right, and we try to have all the interconnected parts, and we have the 21st century competencies, we have the social learning, we have everything going on all at once, it will fail. Mm-hmm. But if we make one step forward, test it, roll it out, and are careful about it, we can get to success. This is the idea of a minimum viable product. I know my tech folks in here know this term, right? An MVP. In other words, we don't want something like this at the top, right? Where you're building a car by building one wheel, and then the next wheel, and then you build the chassis, and then ultimately at the end, you finally get the car. Instead, we want to do something like at the bottom, where we build these incremental releases that we can incrementally evolve the system slowly over time. So that's my recommendation to you. This is another one that kind of just emphasizes the same thing, right? So don't try to just build the functionality at the beginning, but really think through all the pieces of the system, but just at a smaller scale, and slowly evolve it. All right. So this is the recommendations for what you all need to be working on to make the system into this concept of a future learning ecosystem, but one that functions and doesn't actually do more harm than good in the future. So if you recall, we had talked about what are the practical applications of this for CAP at the tactical and strategic level. And so I'd like to hear from you. What are the takeaways that you have here? What are things that you think could be done within this community to make a real, meaningful step forward towards this future learning ecosystem vision? Thanks for your time, and I'm really interested to hear what you all have to say.
I've actually lost sleep on this issue, and I want to thank you because the light bulb went off when you brought something up. I'm Lieutenant Colonel Rob Tucker, I'm General Public Health staff, and we've been challenged directly to optimize the first year or two someone's in the military, and the word from our Chief of Defense staff was rapid. It's not my word. And one of your things came up, David, everything was relevant, and you said, train closer to the need.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And then I'm thinking, oh my goodness, how many times have we did what we call train, don't train decisions for TKASLs? And we say, is it needed? Oh yeah, it's needed. But never did we ever ask, when will it be needed post operational functional point? And never do we ask, if we delay it, what's the risk? If we delay it, can we enable that learning on the job, or on operations even, with technology? So I guess I want to say thank you, because I looked at how can we make it more rapid to operational functional point when the delays aren't that large, the alignment isn't too bad, but the largest amount of time spent in training is in a classroom with PowerPoint on. And one of the ways we can avoid that, and I want to thank you for making the light bulb go off this morning, was that train closer to need. Yeah, we can. And if you do delay it, there are people with technology enablers to help us. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Please. You should come up here. We can stand up here together.
This was very important because when you talk about professional development, people say you can be shut down their throat. So
right.
It's a very nice, warm, you know, approach to it. So it is kind of fixed. So I have all these things that they need to know, grow, learn, and they move into their career. But they're faced with all the day-to-day operational tempo. You have to do this, get to do this, exercise, all this. And I'm saying, but you have to find all these other things. You read it out, which is just reading and reading. So they say,
So you have all of these operations, right? You're sitting at your desk, and you're supposed to do your professional development through distributed learning, maybe, right? And then the phone's ringing, and you're looking at your Twitter account, and then people are coming by your office, and then you know you have that, you know, thing you have to fill out by the end of the day. And so what are all those things that are affecting your executive functioning, right? And so then what's really getting the professional development? Like, maybe your elephant brain, maybe.
It's not. It's not paying attention, right? Exactly. It's not. So when they retain, they brought to the training, right? And because this is school is still at work, I have to do it at home, and now they have their spouse to say, well, you know, I want you to do this, and the kids saw through it all this. So this was very helpful, and I really appreciate your small incremental changes, because as I was writing notes, you say something, and I'm telling you, you know, how am I going to do this, do this, do this, small incremental changes.
One of the things that I was keying in, coming up these great ideas, we start, we excited, and we post it. The other person coming behind us goes, what? And then it falls, it's small, it's big. Thank you, thank you, appreciate that. I think also she brings up a really good point, which is, you know, what were some of the reasons why PD sometimes fails? We're distracted by things around us. The internet is slow, maybe the user interface isn't great. Like, none of those had anything to do with the pedagogy, the curriculum, right, the instructional design. So you could have the best quality content in the best quality instructional design and still have it fail. So we need to maybe be less parochial about how we achieve our training and education outcomes, right? Because it's not always about doing the best job I can as a teacher or trainer. Sometimes it's about talking to the IT folks and making sure that they have good bandwidth. Or sometimes it's about, you know, talking, right? Or talking to the manager and making sure that people have a place to go where they don't have, you know, interruptions during it. So when I talk about the strategic level ideas here, that's some of the stuff I'm talking about. Because we can't just be successful by only living in our little swim lane here. We have to open our aperture bigger and really think about the achievement of those outcomes. It's just what you were talking about too, sir, right? So if you are really focused on being the best trainer, you're focused on how do I get all these training objectives completed in the amount of time I have, versus saying, wait, let me see if I can talk to the schedulers and maybe move some of these requirements later on, right? So opening our aperture. Sorry, please.
So to carry on to this discussion with both of what Lieutenant Colonel Tucker was saying and you, ma'am, what I've heard, I am a training development officer working at the School of Military Engineering, and the point of me training is seen as good in theory, but not practically achievable because nobody's available at the point of need, and the risk of making point of need training and not having something on, let's say, a basic occupational course is that they don't then get the training at point of need and people are unprepared when they're
being. Yeah, so what do we do? What do we do as a community to facilitate good quality informal and social learning? We kind of hope and pray and
approach incrementally.
Huh?
Approach incrementally.
Well, this is my point, though, and I think this is also probably part of your point, is that we could probably foster better conditions to make it more likely, but oftentimes it's more about throwing it over the fence and hoping someone else will pick it up.
Well, our training system produces novices. At the end of a formal training session, you're a novice, because then the idea is you gain expertise on the job. The field force looks at the training establishment and says, train people that are ready to do the job, and then they get to the field force and they're so busy doing all the other stuff that maybe they don't get the opportunity to practice these skills that they're novice at, and then they go back to their next career course and they haven't done the thing that they learned on the one before yet. So
or forgotten one before.
Right, exactly.
Hold on a second.
So
to
recommend for me working at TCAS, I'm thinking about that new concept of training and of developing, and I was wondering, because all day yesterday there was one problem that was present in the courses, and it's something that prevents us a long time, it's those people waiting to get training. So I'm wondering if with that thinking, we can develop small capsules of learning or informal learning or what they call sometimes micro learning.
Mm-hmm.
And instead of seeing that as a problem, all those people waiting, more seeing that as how can we use that time of wait with capsule, micro learning, and I'm thinking even we were talking about people coming in skills, semi-skills, those people, they don't need to wait a year or, I'm thinking, why don't we start thinking about very efficient, but like informal kind of learning and just train the military side and make them effective and start.
So I love what you're talking about. I mean, you're talking about human capital supply chain management, right? Ma'am, you probably know all about Lean, Six Sigma factors with logistics and how we can better optimize the flow of quality products through a system. This is what you're talking about too, right? How do we optimize the flow of quality individuals, humans, that make it through the system at a high level of mastery, in other words, that meet the quality rubric, right? Because we can leverage that. I love the creative thinking.
Well, I'm just going to tackle on that one because actually that has been something we've been looking into, and we started that about a year and a half ago, but again, it comes in resources, right? The idea that someone that's awaiting training, in essence, is going to get program handed to them to tell them, right, so first and foremost, while you're awaiting training, what can you do that's going to give you additional skill sets? So I'll use the MSC op because it's a relatively easy one. So while that driver's awaiting to actually get on a formal course, you can do air brakes online. Your air brakes course online will need to improve that because it's a requirement for your training anyway. Work through all of that list. Then move on to what it is that, from an environmental perspective, there's things that you can do. some mandatory training. And then there's some path wide. So one of the best things we could actually do is probably to create a very simple admin course that everyone could actually take. Because all that stuff we teach in basic training, they walk up and they get why it is you have to fill out your next PIN form in a very specific way. But all of it aimed at making their time valued. Because we didn't go to all that effort on the recruiting side to bring them in, only to make them sit around. But it's got to be done in a way that is structured. We're going to be, if we actually want to make sure that, you know, there's not something that's optional, that they're going to get through this. But also it's laying the groundwork for them to understand that as you move through your career, that they also start to take that initiative, right? And the aspiration for the DLN is in fact to grow the DLN so that the DLN, as we move into Sabbath Cloud, we'll get that briefing this afternoon, becomes our sort of online environment to be able to do things like micro-learning, to be able to connect with different communities and have discussions, to tap into the rich wealth of material and programs that are out there so that you can become an ongoing learner, both for the benefit of yourself professionally within your occupation, but as a member of the Canadian Armed Forces, and as an individual. So it's there, but it does need a lot of input to make that happen.
Mm-hmm. Can I have one more?
Well,
we've got 10 minutes.
Okay. Oh, I can find one. Faith, good to see you again.
Yeah, you too.
I think I'd like to wrap this, or to kind of link it back to something that General Tattersall, you said yesterday, when you talked about being warriors and our warrior identity. We have the perfect kind of wrapper to put around all of this. If we are going to focus on teaching our folks to be, you know, fighting sailors and warriors, then teaching self-regulatory KSAOs is part of being a warrior. Acknowledging and embracing informal learning is part of being an ever-improving warrior. We have a social, emotional, and cultural outcome as described in our ethos. And making small incremental changes is, again, part of that ever-improving identity that we should all have as being warriors. I'm afraid to say, I think at times we lose the fact that our ultimate goal here is to be fighting people in a fighting force defending Canada. If we keep that as our lead mark, to use a legal term, then we can do all this and we can actually inculcate that into our culture. So that's my offer.
I love that you said that too, because oftentimes you hear these things and they're like, metacognition. Well, I don't even know what that is, right? Thinking about my own thinking or like emotional regulation, that's squishy, right? I don't need that, but I really appreciate it. Those are so essential.
So I guess I'm going to mention the one aspect that no one's mentioned at all with change. Money. And there, you know, everyone's talking about creating this change and making things better. We're in the process of trying to make one of our TVs better, but we're also getting told from the top down, we can't afford it. And something tells me with the whole stuff we're going to cover today with different aspects of training, technology, and all that, great idea. Where's the cash money?
So I love what you're saying, that I am going to compensation benefits, no cash. However, Bill Rader and SAVE are actually one of the ways to get some of the things we need. Because although they didn't go into a lot of detail about the Adaptive Distributed Learning Initiative and what that connects us with, it actually provides the portal for us not to have to be doing all of this by ourselves. If you look at some of the things that the Norwegians have been doing in the medical environment in terms of training, a lot of it that has been focused on assisting Latvians and Ukrainians to improve their skills. Or you look at some of the pieces that they've been doing in New Zealand around something that we were looking at from New Zealand. Mm-hmm. All that to say that all these partners that we have in the ADL have all got the same challenges in terms of resources, are all looking at a lot of these sort of different ways that we can develop material, whether that be software, content. We're now adding in a rich layer, and you will see a number of them represented here today. I encourage you to have discussions with our own other government departments. But now we've got the whole of the U.S. Department of Defense. We've got academia, we've been working with Queen's University. All of that to say to you that it's not necessarily all about the money resources or the intellectual properties, but what it is our willingness to do the work to say, okay, well, I've got this idea, but maybe that I don't have to be the one that develops it. I don't need a bunch of resources. I can tap into the ADL because there is no intellectual property restrictions on anything that someone within the ADL has developed that we can bring in. So the software that is going to drive the simulators, the CFLTC, and I forget the name of the company that is developing.
Simulator.
Simulator is a tremendous opportunity for us that, in fact, it's a Canadian company. But what's being built onto that, we're leveraging some of the work that has been done for other countries. So yes, resources are a challenge, but what's more so the challenge is is not sort of being able to get some of this, not bringing it in. It's that cultural obstacle of ourselves thinking, well, this is too hard and there's not enough time. But if we don't make this effort, frankly, we're going to fail the Canadian Armed Forces because the ships that the Navy is bringing online, we're already seeing training that's being developed for the ships because I've worn the little goggles where you walk up and you're changing parts, which is scary if I'm changing parts on an ocean ship. But it's there and we've got to be there. And it's today. Never mind, you're going to hear later today from one of our speakers where we think we're going to go in the future. So there is some sacrifice we need to make. There's some decisions we need to make about how we're delivering training now. There's some extra effort that's required. But it's on the part of all you. That's why you are here today, is to kickstart the gears in your brains as to how do I make those small changes? Where could this be effective? What can I go back and maybe have a discussion about the changes that we could make incrementally? Yeah, it's not going to be easy. There's never going to be enough resources. But there are ways that we can make this happen. But we've got to be willing to make that change. You have to be the change, or else we're going to continue to just get closer and closer to the charm of it, and we're going to fail the Canadian Armed Forces.
One last.
Yeah, sure.
Thank you, Neil Martino. I'm the Chief Standards Officer at Canadian Forces Rangers. So I just have a quick comment regarding informal social learning, and I think one of the concerns that I think a lot of schools will probably have is standards, because one of the things that at some of the schools that I've been at is when students start trying to learn things on their own, we have to say, no, don't do that, because you may learn the wrong way, and in accordance with the principle of primacy, the first way they learn it is the way it's going to stick the most. If they learn it wrong, then what happens is that they have to unlearn it and then relearn it again.
So the question here, for those who couldn't hear in the back, was, if we open ourselves up to informal and social learning, what if people get incorrect information? And I think this actually goes to what the general was just talking about here a minute ago, right, which is the idea of culture change. We're going to have to start to rethink the way that we do some of this training and education, and in some places allow ourselves to have a modicum of risk, right, appropriate levels. This is similar to the point of need discussion, right? Because if we continue to prioritize everything at 100% level at the beginning, then we won't have the resources to do it. We won't have the human resources, we won't have the monetary resources. So we have to really rethink the way that we do training and education writ large, right? I don't mean just the way we design the curriculum, right? That's the parochial, small, myopic way of looking at it. Important, but not holistic. And so, absolutely right. We need to find that right balance. As mentioned in the book, there's a chapter on social learning. There's a chapter on informal learning as well. And it talks about ways that you can integrate that into an organization. Because it's not an all or nothing. It's not like, well, you're just going to learn it from your buddies, or you're just going to learn it in the classroom. So how do we make sure that we can have that healthy blend of the two?
So that it's by design, not ad hoc.
Yeah, exactly. So that we can help put some guidance on it. But again, it goes back to culture change. We have to be willing to make those decisions organizationally and to prioritize the places that we have to have 100%, looking you in the eyeballs kind of training versus whether places that we can do on the job, informal, social, or accept different kinds of risk. And also, if we teach people those self-regulation skills, if we can teach people
people to be better at determining what information is good, how to go out and seek quality information, and how to infuse it to better. That's almost like, it's almost like a cheat code, right? We're almost like wishing for more wishes from the genie when we teach people how to teach themselves. And so I think they all have to go hand in hand like that. All right, so I'm seeing the body language here.
Thank you so much for taking time away from the seminar. It was really
Oh, I'm delighted to take time
away. I have a nice selection of maple products, and I hope to give you a strong maple leaf jersey.